raised by an abusive aunt. I mean, I saw the amount of trauma she had, and she pulled herself up by her bootstraps, and she was very successful. But she struggled with her weight around this. And this is what we call adverse childhood events. And for her, you know, I think she tried this medication and it really helped her to kind of get back to a level where she could get off the 50, 60, 70, 80 pounds that she needed to get off. And so, you know, it's humbling as a doctor to know, you know, when you can't get people to do the right thing for some reason, whether it's their trauma, whether it's their emotional state, whether it's their brain functioning or their brain inflammation, sometimes these compounds can be helpful. So I kind of like to kind of not just do all good, all bad, and go, I think we can all agree that the way that the pharmaceutical industry is doing this is bad. Like, I don't think any of us have any argument about that. I don't think any of us have an argument that you know, pharma shouldn't be driving all the research. It shouldn't be driving all the marketing. That shouldn't be driving all the co-opting of the research institutions, the professional associations, the physicians promoting it, you know, the government lobbyists, you know, I mean, you know, they're trying to get approved for Medicare. I'm like, well, gee, you know, for Medicare Part D, which is the drug benefit, mm-hmm. the total benefit for all everybody on all drugs in all America is $145 billion. If just the obese triple people F. in Medicare got this, it would be, I think, $267 billion, which is, you know, more staring. Than all the rest of the yeah. drug benefit put together. So that is not a solution. We're working, for example, in Washington, trying to get food as medicine covered. We're going to get there, but it's a decade-long fight. In the meantime, we're heading into some crazy period of metabolic disaster in America that we need to do something. So I would like to kind of go back to Tina and talk to Tina about her approach with her patients, because I was, to be just honest, I was pretty skeptical. I was like, I don't know. I think I prescribed it maybe one or two times in very select patients who really had to get the weight off. They had Alzheimer's or they had something really serious, and I used it very carefully. But I really had a very similar perspective to you, Callie, that this is something that we should really not be using. That lifestyle works better. That you know, that if you look, for example, at the studies of gastric bypass, which is the other treatment, which is, by the way, far cheaper if you're paying retail for these things. Mm-hmm. If you give someone a gastric bypass and then you have someone eat the same diet as if they had a gastric bypass, there was no difference in the outcomes. So as to paraphrase Bill Clinton, it's the food, stupid, right? And I was like, wait a minute, is this, if people just did a study, and they've never done this study, because I looked to see if there was a study done. Was there a study comparing diet, aggressive dietary intervention, the same diet people would eat on a GLP-1 agonist with a GLP-1 agonist, and looked at all these effects? Would neuroinflammation go down? Would fatty liver improve? Would heart failure reverse? I think it would. I don't know how the study would work, but I had a patient like this. She was 66 years old. She had heart failure, fatty liver. She had diabetes. She had all these problems. We didn't use Ozempic. We just used food, and she was off all her medications in 3 months. She lost 43 pounds in 3 months, 116 pounds in a year, and she got reversal of all these inflammatory things. So would she have been helped even more with Ozempic? I don't know. So this is a question I have, and I kind of want Tina to you to talk through how you use this with your patients, because it's a very different approach than I think we're talking about with what's happening wide scale in the country. It's like, go to the doctor, you give Ozempic. Now you can buy it online. You can go to Ozempic like websites, and they talk to you for 5 minutes. They give you the drug, right. And it's like a prescription mail that I think should be illegal. But I think in the right patient, in the right way, tell us what you're seeing.
Well, first of all, I don't use anything in isolation. So the foundations are always the foundations, right? Diet, lifestyle, exercise, sun, all of those are always critical. Sometimes people aren't ready to implement all of those things, and it's quite a bit overwhelming, as you've seen with your patients. You got to start with one thing. I also never use peptides in isolation. I like you, use a multitude of them with patients. And I also usually bring in some bioidentical hormone replacement as needed, depending on their age and their condition. And so this is just but one tool in a comprehensive tool belt. And when done that way, I found that you can keep the dose significantly low. And then I cycle it. So just like a hormone.
So not on it for life.
No.
On and off.
On and off, just like I do a hormone. So that off period may be 1 week out of the month. It may be a month out of every quarter. It may be go off for a period of time and go back on when you need it.
And do they gain the weight back when they do that?
Or? Not if they're metabolically optimized. So I really think that peptides in general work best in folks who are metabolically optimized. Mm-hmm. So I'm not defending this for strictly weight loss. I'm using it as an adjunctive tool in a comprehensive toolbox to get people that leg up so that they have the energy, they start to drop the weight, they start to do all the things, or they do better at doing all the things, right? It might be the patient is doing all the things, but they've got a crazy sugar addiction. Or who knows what it is? Again, mold exposure, Lyme disease. It could be a myriad of things that's keeping their glucose elevated. They are doing everything perfectly and their blood sugar is still elevated. I've seen patients like that. Mm-hmm. You're like, how is this? How are we still dealing with this elevated hemoglobin A1C? Yeah. You're lean, you're fit, you're doing everything right, you're eating like a saint. A touch, just a little touch of something, it's not always a GLP-1, but there's something that they need. And when we give that, we give what the body needs, it responds in favor and they improve.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say, most women I know on bioidentical hormone replacement will tell you we don't mind taking it for the rest of our lives. Yeah. I don't plan on getting off thyroid. I have no desire to get off thyroid. I have no plan of getting off of my estrogen. I have no desire to.
Well, let's talk about this, because I think what's in the literature and concerns me is some of the side effects, right? And I think, Kelly, maybe that's what you're about to say.
So I hear you on the metabolically optimized person, but for somebody like more than 50% of American adults, by some measures up to 60%, have prediabetes. I think 80% or so don't know it. Most people listening are, you know, have indicators of metabolic dysfunction. Like, generically, if it's better for metabolically functional people, which is a very small percentage of the country, what's the high level protocol?
Well, no, what she was saying was peptides work better in
all
metabolic
peptides.
But like
they work
anything,
in everyone,
right?
But they work best when you're in the, you can keep the dosage low when folks are generally healthy. Now,
insulin. If someone's very insulin resistant and type 2 diabetic, they need a lot of insulin to lower their blood sugar. But if someone's insulin sensitive, they need a tiny bit of insulin, right? If they're
so somebody that is metabolic dysfunctional will need a good deal more?
Not necessarily. It depends on when they start implementing lifestyle changes. Some people need some help getting there. And the other piece is that I don't think people need to be on them for life at high. I certainly don't think people need to be high dose the way that they're being dosed. I think that was just the way the studies were ran. Mm-hmm. We're also dealing with a population when we're talking about diabetes and obesity who are already prone to pancreatitis. They're already prone to thyroid cancer. They're already prone to gastroparesis. I mean, the number one risk factor for gastroparesis is
diabetes.
Type 2 diabetes. And the number one risk factor for thyroid cancer generally is diabetes and obesity. So you have two times the risk. So I'm talking about intervention, because these peptides actually, they don't act as just a Band-Aid, Kelly. They heal your metabolism. They heal your pancreas. They heal your liver. They heal your metabolism.
Well, that's an interesting concept, because, like, for example, I use BP-157 when I have and I work out and I get a little strain of muscle. I just pop it in there and it's better. So it regenerates tissue. It repairs tissue. I had a guy who was an elite athlete and he pulled a muscle in his calf and he couldn't do all the things he had to do. I just popped a peptide in there. Someone else, a tennis elbow, I popped a BP-157 GHK peptide in there, and I did maybe a couple of times and it resolved the problem. Now, That I think GLP-1 agonists may be a little bit different. I don't know, but they do have a regenerative capacity. That's what these peptides are meant to do in the body. So they're different than drugs, and I think that the pharmaceutical approach is concerning to me, because it doesn't include a holistic approach.
Right.
And you and I do that, obviously, and there are some doctors around the country who are focused on that. But most of the people getting these drugs are just getting them.
True.
And then they have some significant issues. So at the dose that we're seeing that people are getting, there's very high rates of nausea, very high rates of diarrhea, constipation, like 20-25%, probably 67% of nausea. It tends to go away after a little bit, but it still is a problem. And 80% discontinue them after, I think, a couple of years or a year or two, which is an interesting phenomenon, whether it's cost or side effects or maybe I don't know what. And then there's the risk of some of these other issues. Now, the absolute number is small because these are rare conditions. But, you know, when you look at the data, published data, there's 450% increased risk in bowel obstruction, a 900% increased risk in pancreatitis. These seem not trivial. And if you scale it out on the population, and the incidence of this, I don't know, 100 million people are taking it, might be 500,000 people with it, which is not trivial. So how do you think about these side effects? How do you see these being different in the patients that you use the microdosing, as you call microdose? I wouldn't call it microdose, I'd call it low dose.
Yeah, it's low dose.
Microdose is like micro, but low dose, I think you're using low dose, which is, I think, an interesting concept. And by the way, people, you cannot get low dose through the drug companies.
No, the brand name can't.
You have to go through compounding pharmacies. And we're going to talk about that and the challenge with that. But there's a way to get it and do it, but it's tricky and you need to be with the right practitioner. But given these side effects, and you talk about what you think about these, are they as bad as we think? you know, are they just in the people who are on high doses? You know, do you see this in the population who are using smaller doses as you're talking about?
I'm not seeing it in any of my patients. The study that you're referencing, you're right, it was a small, I mean, I think it was like 7 out of 600 and something got the bowel obstruction.
Right.
You know, 7 people, which looks terrible as a hazard ratio, but.
Right.
And when you scale it out, yes, I agree. But I think we're talking management and dosing being the problem. And when you overdose somebody on a peptide or anything, I mean, when I take too much BPC-157, I swell up. Mm-hmm. And I get swollen throughout my body. I get edema. So overdosing somebody on a GLP-1 is, I think, is what's happening. And then we're taking brittle. They're metabolically brittle. Mm. Their vagus nerve is damaged already. Their muscle tissue is already pathologic and full of fatty infiltrate.
Like,
and then we're slamming them.
Ribeye, Wagyu ribeye.
Yeah, and then we're slamming them with monotherapy, high-dose GLP-1s. I think it's a disaster.
So for listeners, if they listen to this and go to their doctor and get the prescription of Ozempic,
they're not
saying often that is an overdose.
Yes.
It's actually very dangerous. So
I don't think it's very dangerous. I think in the wrong person, it could be.
Yeah, it tends to have more side effects.
Yes, you're going to get more side effects. And the gastroparesis is not permanent, regardless of what the clickbait headlines are telling us.
Meaning when your stomach kind of stops working, if you stop the drug, it'll come back to.
Yeah, it comes back online. The thyroid cancer is correlative at best.
Yes, in rats.
Right? It's been in rats. That black box warning is in rats that were given like.
Cancer that doesn't even occur.
You're saying
in humans?
You're downplaying that the black box warning?
No, it's in rats.
But you're saying
there's
that's
no
not
human
to worry
cases.
About?
There's literally no human cases showing positive.
I will just say that for the FDA, which is 75% funded by pharma, which is basically a subsidiary of pharma, for them to take the step of putting a black box warning means there's pretty scary data, in my opinion, on the thyroid cancer.
Well, I was going to finish. They took the rat and they gave them 100 times the human dose, and they got a very rare form of medullary thyroid cancer that rats developed spontaneously, and the control group also got a high rate of medullary thyroid cancer.
But
so I'm not downplaying anything.
I'm talking about what the Cleveland
Clinic is showing for the actual data.
You're saying, just for listeners, should they be concerned about thyroid issues, hormonal issues leading up to thyroid cancer?
They should talk to their doctor. And if they have a history of medullary thyroid cancer in their family, they should absolutely. That's a doctor-patient relationship discussion. I'm not defending Ozempic. Yeah. And I'm not defending it at high doses for weight loss. I'm talking about nuance. We're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
I think that's an important point, Tina. I think we have to do it in the right way, in the right context for the right patient. I always say, you know, there's a Buddhist concept called the right medicine. What is the right medicine for this person? Is it a motherectomy if they're 50 years old living with their mother that's driving them crazy? Or do they need exercise? Or then they need the right nutrient they're deficient in? Or do they need to have some support for their metabolism? And I think, you know, this conversation is hard because we're threading a very tight needle here, which is at scale in the population, the way it's being done now, I think is problematic. But is there another alternative to think about this that we can basically encourage people to think about that includes an aggressive lifestyle intervention with some peptide support, which I use across many, many other peptides. I use many peptides in my practice for just general therapeutic treatments that support the body's own endogenous functioning, which is what I love about peptides. I love things that nature made, not that God made, not that man made, because they tend to be more problematic. That doesn't mean that these don't have side effects when you use them in huge doses. Looks like vitamin D, right? So one of the things that also is a problem is muscle loss. And there's a lot of the data is very clear on this. There's been DEXA scans and some of the studies showing significant weight loss. But the truth is, if you just lose weight without exercising and eating protein, you're going to have the same result.
It's the same percentage on a low calorie diet.
Right. So if you calorie restrict and you don't eat protein and you don't strength train, you are going to lose muscle, and you'll lose muscle and fat at about 50% each. And when you gain the weight back, you gain back all fat. And so you screw up your metabolism if you do the weight cycling, and which is a real problem. So how do you address some of the concerns? Because aside from the protein increase needs, when people are on these drugs, they tend to have suppressed appetite. So they don't want to eat as much protein, and they don't want to eat as much food. And then they may be even at risk for nutrient deficiencies. So how do you deal with those kinds of issues?
Well, first off, I think that's a dosing issue. If you pull back the dosage low enough, people have an appetite and they continue to eat regularly. And interestingly, I've got people claiming to eat the same amount of calories and still having visceral fat loss, and they're tracking themselves. Mm. So there's something changing there. We have data to show that it decreases visceral fat while maintaining and actually inducing muscle protein synthesis GLP-1s induce muscle protein synthesis through various signaling pathways and through perfusion, blood perfusion, and delivery of amino acids. It's folks going on a severely calorically restricted diet that is causing the muscle loss. Mm-hmm. The doctors are cranking the dose too high, too fast. They're being ramped up way too fast. It's crushing their appetite. They're going into an anorexic state, and they are indeed losing everything. And just like you said, they're going to end up way worse off at the end of this terrible journey. And so I don't disagree with that. I always say that strength training is non-negotiable. And I've said that for decades.
Yeah.
Strength training is non-negotiable, period. If you want to live a long, healthy life and be metabolically optimized and survive the zombie apocalypse, you have to strength train.
Getting people to the gym is tough, right?
It really is. And so we can blame the doctors. We can blame the pharmaceutical industry. But I'm talking to the patients because you and I both know that compliance is an issue with patients. And they don't always do what we want them to do. And they don't always do what we need them to do. So my patients understand the prescription ends if you don't strength train.
Yeah.
I will pull this out. Like, we will no longer be dispensing this. So strength training, optimizing. So
they need to have their Fitbit or their Apple Watch or their Oura Ring data pumped to directly to you so you can see.
Well, I can tell by touching them. I'm a chiropractor. I can tell by their muscle integrity just by putting my hands on them, whether they're, you know, good musculature or fatty, flaccid muscle.
It's not a
muscle.
Bad idea, right? It's not a bad idea to support people and have them track and be accountable as they're doing this because, you
know. That's helpful.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're all in agreement. And I just want to tailor, the person I have in my head is the median American who is on the fence about Ozempic, who's hearing the PR that this should be the, you know, standard of care for somebody that's overweight or obese. And I want to be clear kind of what we're all agreeing on here, which is that Ozempic at the recommended dose, at the dose you would get from your doctor if you go get it, is essentially an injectable crash diet.
That's not all it is. There's a ton of regeneration and healing happening from the peptide.
So, that's right. I think it's important to talk about what we call pleiotropic effects in medicine, which is the multiple kinds of effects on the body from one compound that's in the body.
Well, if we're going to talk about the interconnectedness of the body, you know, I think we should look at the 80% of people, you know, having serious side effects. And you mentioned the mental health, but the data is pronounced impact in mental health
issues.
That's
not correct.
Well, there's an EU investigation into suicidal ideation.
And they came back and said it was not an issue.
They have not. There's a serious investigation going on in EU that is not resolved. It impacts the drug. Tell me if the drug is basically gut dysfunction. It messes with our gut where 95% of our serotonin is made. If we're going to talk about
it actually shifts your microbiome into a favorable microbiome and out of a pathologic microbiome.
If we're going to talk about the interconnectivity of the body and the interconnectivity of this drug, I think we would all agree there's much more we don't understand about how this drug impacts the myriad of metabolic dynamics going on.
I think there's mixed data, right? I think, you know, there's some data that showed that there was a study looking at antidepressant effects of GLP-1 receptor agonists. It was a meta-analysis with 2,000 people, 5 randomized trials, 1 prospective cohort study, and it was about 24 to 60 weeks. And they found that actually it reduced depression in adults and both adults and adults with type 2 diabetes. So
there's also studies
that show that maybe it's not.
I've got a question. So this drug, we're saying it's a miracle drug that makes you not want to eat, that makes you not want to gamble, that makes you not want to have sex in some cases, there's reports of. It basically decreases, it seems like, desires. So are you worried that there's an impact this drug has on our dopamine or serotonin levels?
It actually improves dopamine signaling.
By making us not want to engage in the activities that bring us joy?
No, it impacts the HPA axis and imparts a dopaminergic effect.
So you're saying flatly that a drug...
It's not a drug, it's a peptide, and they're overdosing people on it, and that's why they're having terrible side effects. And also, when people lose a tremendous amount of weight too fast, they get depressed and suicidal.
So you're not concerned about unknown impacts to our dopamine or serotonin from a drug that, by all reports, makes us want to do less of the things that bring us joy?
Well, just eating. I don't know if
there's studies coming out.
I'm not seeing any appetite suppression.
It's being used as a gambling cessation
and
an alcohol cessation.
Well, that's good, though.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But it's literally making
us
not want to do almost everything. That's what the drug's being credited as doing.
I'm
just saying that doesn't indicate
some... I'm not hearing that from people.
You know what? There's an interesting conversation here about dopamine because I think we have dysregulated dopamine, and I do genetic testing with my patients, and we see polymorphisms or variations in DR. Dopamine receptors, DRD2 receptors, which affect pleasure. So some people may need a lot of a substance, whether it's alcohol or sugar or gambling, to actually feel pleasure. And so there are people who are at risk for increased obesity. It's based on this sort of low hedonic drive to pleasure. And I think the question is, do these drugs modify that in some way? Do they actually not do it in a bad way, but maybe they do it in a good way? Because I think if there's something that can actually help people reduce their addiction and reduce that drive and actually have pleasure from things that are just things that we all get pleasure from, that would be better.
Let's just, I'm just trying to use common sense here, right? I'm not saying it's a bad thing that people are eating a little bit less, that gambling less, engaging in alcohol less, engaging in drug use less. But if this drug is basically across the board making people want to do less of things, that to me demonstrates potential concerns, unknown concerns with impacts on our dopamine and serotonin levels. I think that's a serious concern.
My joke always is that there's a study in the New England Journal years ago that said we should start to use these new drugs as soon as they come out before the side effects develop. So we don't know what's going to happen in 5, 10, 15 years. We really don't.
Well, we have 20 years of data on GLP-1s, just not semaglutide and tirzepatide. And we weren't hearing all of this, these huge mainstream media headlines before that, with exenatide that's been around for 20 years, right, and liraglutide. And
yeah, I mean, there's mixed data on the suicide thing, and some of it's population data. The clinical trials don't show that. There's big horde studies of 240,000 people, 1.6 million patients with diabetes prescribed Ozempic, 240,000 on Wegovy, and there's a lower incidence of suicidal thoughts in patients. And so I think, you know, I don't think we know. We just have to keep tracking it. I think you're right. It's good to be concerned, and we do need to do post-market surveillance of what's going on with these drugs and how they impact people's health. But that sort of, you know, like I'm sitting here honestly, like kind of in the middle and also confused, because part of me is like, God, wouldn't it be great to have a leg up? Because I've been treating people with obesity and overweight issues for 30 years, and it's tough. It's really tough for them. They really struggle. They want to do the right thing, and they're highly motivated patients, and it's still tough. And so I wonder, you know, this is not a miracle drug. I don't think Tina would say it's a miracle drug. I think, you know, like any compound, it has a role. And so is there a role? How do we use it? Does it make sense to actually think about this differently from how the traditional pharmacological medical approach is doing something, and do we just not dismiss it wholesale as a part of an overall solution? So I think, you know, in the perfect world, we'd totally fix our food system. We would get rid of all the junk. I mean, I had this crazy idea that if we actually gave Ozempic, everybody's overweight, all of a sudden people would stop eating junk food and that industry would collapse and everything would be great. In fact, the CEO of Novo Nordisk, who makes Ozempic, was getting calls from people in the fast food and junk food industry really concerned about this.
Yep.
McDonald's is concerned about this, because it's cutting into their stomach share, we call it stomach share, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, the CEO of Cheez-Its, the fact that there is a CEO of Cheez-Its cracks me up. But the CEO of Cheez-Its said, we will keep an eye on this. And they're actually, you know, doing a detour and coming up with potentially supplements to offset their snack sales because they're down. The joint replacement companies are concerned. Dialysis clinic companies are concerned. You know, there's a lot of
a
lot of big companies that are concerned about this as well. So I feel like, and here's just a total, you know, out in left field. I actually think big pharma is concerned. I think the big pharma companies who don't hold a patent on a GLP-1 agonist are very concerned, because they happen to be the ones who hold the patents on the popular statin drugs and blood pressure drugs that every American ends up on for life. So I really wonder if big pharma isn't actually, you know, depend, you know, war of the big pharma companies. I don't know. I'm speculating, but I've been.
They're thrilled because comorbidities are going to go up.
Are they though?
Yeah, because
if we do it right. If we do it how we're doing it now, but if we do it right.
This is why it's zero sum and why it's so important. Comorbidities are going to go up because that happens literally with every chronic disease drug in the history of modern America. They would be literally the first to not be correlated with increased chronic disease. Here's why. Because if you are saying, and I want to understand where you're, because you're saying it's a good thing. It seems like that the standard of care, that the high dose is actually going to lead to a lot of reduction in comorbidities. That's the track we're on. We're on the track with a very high dose being open season for the majority of the American people. And if the standard of care when a child is overweight is to prescribe them this drug and not talk to them about your books.
Right.
But we're saying that comorbidities are going to go down at scale as this drug is widely prescribed. That's what we're on the verge of doing.
I think we're giving doctors a little less credit than they deserve.
Well, we might disagree on that.
I purposely did not become an MD because I wouldn't do it. I purposely became a naturopathic doctor because I didn't actually have
to. I wanted to go to naturopathic school.
I wasn't going to work for the evil empire. So, from the get-go. I have been watching every single webinar piece of information that every single medical platform has put out. Medscape, every single one.
On this topic.
I have been doing nothing but consuming information about this. And in every case, the doctors, the obesity doctors, obesity specialists mean well. They all talk, especially I watched a whole one on childhood obesity, and they were like, we don't want to be injecting children. We can talk about children exercising more and children eating better and children doing all the things. Really, the issue is their parents.
It's the schools, it's the whole environment.
Aren't trying to poison their children.
Actually, most children who suffer from obesity have obese parents.
Okay. So we have a situation where
I wasn't 80%.
Sorry, go ahead.
In all of these webinars, they specifically double down on lifestyle.
Yeah.
They specifically double down on lifestyle. And I'm not bought out by Big Pharma. I'm not a fan of the allopathic medical community, but I have been watching everything from all sides that I can get my hands on to see where this nuanced conversation is. And in every case, they are talking that we have to be implementing lifestyle strategies for adults and children. And the other part of the conversation
that's true, Tina, but there is no incentives to do that.
I understand.
I agree with you. It would be amazing if we all start with that.
But the doctors are saying it. At least they're trying.
Don't look at what they say. Look at what they do.
They're not in a system that allows them to do it. Every doctor I know would want their patient to exercise and eat more and do less and do better.
Oh yeah, I've talked to Harvard obesity doctors off the record where they said they didn't get into this to see kids be obese, but also that they would be laid off and their entire department would be laid off if they don't have more obese children. And they do understand those incentives. Every obesity doctor.
I think they'd be happy to be out of a job for that. They do find something else to do.
But a person at an obesity clinic who has payroll, who has loans underwritten on their new center that requires more children to be obese. Let me back up.
Sure, there are perverse incentives, but I would push back a little bit on doctors kind of being evil in that way.
I think they're stuck. I don't think they got into this for kids to be obese, but it is just a statement of economic fact that they need more obese children in order to have a job.
Yeah, maybe, but I think if you talk to most physicians who are dealing with this, they would love to sort of magically snap their fingers and have some place to send their patients to do an intensive immersive lifestyle change program. I know that's true.
Okay.
And when I was in Washington in 2008 and 9 during the Obamacare development of the legislation, I was really working hard to insert in the legislation something called the Take Back Your Health Act, where we basically got the government to pay for intensive lifestyle change with a multidisciplinary team over a long period of time to create sustained behavioral change. Because we know how to change behavior, and what you're talking about is behavior change, but we don't have any mechanism in our healthcare system to support behavior change. And that's really the problem. We don't pay for it. We don't incentivize it. We don't have it. No one has how to do it. I mean, I met with Kathleen Sebelius, who was the head of Health and Human Services at the time, and I proposed this idea to her during this time. She says, this is a great idea, but who's going to know how to do it? Because doctors aren't trained to do it. They don't know how to do it. They know anything about nutrition. I'm like, you're right. But let me tell you something. When somebody invented angioplasty, you reimbursed it, you didn't have to worry if they were going to figure out how to do it. If you paid them $10,000 to do that, they'd freaking learn how to do that. And I think we're in the same situation. It's all about perverse financial incentives.
Yeah, let me just double click on that, because I think obviously doctors get in this for the right reason. I really do think they're stuck. But the raw economic fact is that there's been no more profitable invention in the history of modern American capitalism than a sick child. A sick child is the most profitable entity in the world, because that child is not learning metabolically healthy habits and they're continuing to rack up comorbidities. So imagine a high school, right?
Well, long term, they'll be the
imagine
most
a high school. Well, but they're not going to die right away. They're going to suffer.
Very profitable.
So imagine a high school right now. You've had a doubling of prescriptions for SSRI, statins, and metformin among high schoolers, a doubling in less than the past decade. So those drugs are being prescribed like candy. You have a diabetes and pre-diabetes epidemic. You have a high cholesterol epidemic. You have a depression epidemic. You have a high blood pressure epidemic. And you have an obesity epidemic in high schools. And those kids are the most profitable patients in America, because if you can get to them, and say that the high cholesterol is a statin deficiency and the high blood sugar is a metformin deficiency and the obesity is an Ozempic deficiency, they're not learning metabolically healthy habits. It's about the money. Okay, so are doctors evil people? No. Are they complicit in this dynamic knowingly? Absolutely. That is a profitable, if you take that kid, if you take a 12-year-old, and I want to talk to every parent listening right now, it is open season very soon on your 12-year-old to give them Ozempic. You're going to be pushed. You're going to be shoved studies down your face. You're going to be saying you're anti-science if you don't give